going to talk about for the next half an hour or so is, well, it's a talk in the continuing year-long series about building the Buddha land, which if you've been here at all before on a Tuesday, you'll be familiar with that. That's kind of the broad topic that we've been talking about. This month in particular, of course, is Buddhist Action Month, and where we investigate and talk and endeavour to put into practice in the real world, the actual world, our Buddhist aspirations and our Buddhist ethics to make a difference to the real world, to really try and build the Buddha land here and now. And this talk is about somebody that's done just that, I think. So I'm going to introduce that figure now. So, how do you get from a very difficult, disadvantaged beginning, childhood, and end up having an airport named after you? Well, you could be a very successful, famous footballer like George Best, who was my first hero when I was a little lad. Or you could be a renowned, globally renowned musician such as John Lennon. But it's been said that the difference between a great man and an eminent man is that he's prepared to be the servant of the society. He's prepared to be the servant of the society. And I think the guy I'm going to speak about this evening is just such a great man, somebody who has been a servant of his society. And that's Dr. Ambedkar, whose picture is there on the shrine. Or Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, as he's affectionately known in India. So he was born in 1891 in India, in quite difficult circumstances. And I'm going to read you a reading now from his own memoirs, which will say a bit more about that. It's quite a long reading, but if you could bear with me, because I think it kind of paints an interesting picture. So it's about a journey that he makes with some of his siblings. So he says, when my father went to Corrigan, he left me, my brother, who was older than myself, and two sons of my eldest sister, who was dead, in charge of my aunt and some kind neighbours. Being a cashier, my father could not leave his station to come to Satara to see us. Therefore, he wrote to us to come to Corrigan and spend our summer vacation with him. We children were thoroughly excited over the prospect, especially as none of us had up to that time seen a railway train. My father had given us all the particulars regarding our journey and had told us to inform him on which day we were starting so that he would send his pail, his errand runner, to the railway station to meet us and take us to Corrigan. The train arrived at Mysore at about 5 in the evening and we got down with our luggage. We four children remained on the platform looking out for my father or his servant. An hour elapsed and the station master came to inquire. He asked us why we tarried. We were well-dressed children. From our dress or talk, no one could make out that we were children of the untouchables. Indeed, the station master was quite sure we were Brahmin children and was extremely touched at the plight in which he found us. As is usual among the Hindus, the station master asked us who we were. Without a moment's thought, I blurted out that we were Mahars. Mahar is one of the communities which are treated as untouchables in the Bombay Presidency. He was stunned. His face underwent a sudden change. We could see that he was overpowered by a strange feeling of repulsion. We were quite bewildered, and the joy and happiness which we had felt at the beginning of the journey gave way to a feeling of extreme sadness. After half an hour, the station master returned and asked us what we proposed to do. We said that if we could get a bullock cart for hire, we could go to Corrigan. There were many bullock carts plying for hire, but my reply to the station master that we were Mahars had gone around among the cartmen, and not one of them was prepared to suffer being polluted and to demean himself carrying passages of the untouchable classes. We were prepared to pay double the fare, but we found that money did not work. This incident had a very important place in my life. I was a boy of 9 when it happened, so this would have been about 1900, but it has left an indelible impression on my mind. Before the incident occurred, I knew that I was an untouchable, and that untouchables were subject to certain indignities and discriminations. For instance, I knew that in the school I could not sit in the midst of my classmates according to my rank in class performance, but I was to sit in a corner by myself. I knew that in the school I was to have a separate piece of gunny cloth for me to squat on in the classroom, and the servant employed to clean the school would not touch the gunny cloth used by me. I was required to carry the gunny cloth home in the evening and bring it back the next day. While in the school, I knew that children of the touchable classes, when they felt thirsty, could go out to the water tap, open it, and quench their thirst. All that was necessary was the permission of the teacher, but my position was separate. I could not touch the tap, and unless it was opened for it by a touchable person, it was not possible for me to quench my thirst. In my case, permission of the teacher was not enough. The presence of the school peon was necessary, for he was the only person whom the class teacher could use for such a purpose. If the peon was not available, I had to go without water. At home, I knew that the work of washing clothes was done by my sisters. Not that there were no washermen in Satara, not that we could not afford to pay the washermen. Washing was done by my sisters because we were untouchables, and no washerman would wash the clothes of an untouchable. The work of cutting our hair or shaving the boys, including myself, was done by our elder sister, not because there were no barbers in Satara, and not because we could not afford to pay the barber. The work of shaving and haircutting was done by my sister because we were untouchables, and no barber would consent to shave an untouchable. All this I knew, but this incident gave me a shock such as I had never received before. So, Dr. Mbeka, the young Dr. Mbeka, grew up in that sort of environment. And you may be familiar with the caste system in India, but I'll just say a little bit about that. So the caste system is a way by which Hindus are stratified into four levels, four different categories, castes. So you have the Brahmin caste, who are the spiritual leaders. They are the only people who are permitted to learn Sanskrit, the sacred language of the holy texts. They are the only people to be authorized to lead the rituals. Then you have the warrior class. So they were traditionally the warriors, and also the caste from which the leaders, the kings and so on, came. Then you have a merchant caste, which are the buyers and sellers, the traders and so on. And then finally you have the workers, the working caste, who I suppose years gone by you would think of as perhaps being peasants. And then outside the caste system, literally outcasts, are the untouchables. So these are the people that it's their very nature, according to this system, that will pollute the other peoples, which is why they are untouchable. The touchables feel that they would become polluted if they were to touch an untouchable, or drink from the same source as an untouchable, or eat with an untouchable, and so on and so forth. And so that's a system that Dr. Mbeka, along with hundreds of millions of other people, have grown up with, and are growing up with. And of course the caste system is such that if you're born an untouchable, you die an untouchable. You cannot change your caste during your lifetime. Doesn't matter how much money you earn, how much charisma you might have, what education you might get, so on and so forth. You can't change it. So, that's what the situation Dr. Mbeka found himself. And he was relatively fortunate because his father worked for the British Indian Army. And the British Indian Army wasn't too bothered about untouchability and that sort of thing. They didn't mind employing people that Hindus considered untouchable. And his father was the equivalent of a lieutenant in the British Indian Army. And he was the 14th of 14 children. Due to his father's position in the British Indian Army, he was able to get his children into the local government school. And you heard something about the conditions that they faced in the local school, the discrimination and difficulties. But nevertheless, the young Dr. Mbeka did well in school. When he was 16 or 17, he was arranged to be married. So he married he was arranged to be married to his first wife, Ramabai, who was 9 at the time. He was the only one of his siblings who passed all the exams in the government school, and that meant he got to go to quite a prestigious school, the Elphinstone School in what was then Bombay, is now Mumbai. the first untouchable to go to this school. And it was such an event that all his community held a big celebration to recognise his achievement. And he did very well there too. He went on to university and he ended up getting 2 degrees. He got a degree in economics and a degree in political science. Didn't stop there though. He did postgraduate studies there. He went abroad to New York and studied at Columbia University. From there, he travelled further to London and studied at the London School of Economics. In addition to that, he was called to the bar by Gray's Inn in London, which meant he could practice as a barrister. He was proficient in the legal profession, could practice as a lawyer. So he'd done a lot of studying and got a lot of education. But it was time for him to go back to India by this stage. He'd been sponsored in his studies by the state of Baroda, which was a state within British India at the time. So he was obliged to come back and work for the state of Baroda. So he had a job within the administration. So he came back to India to take up his position. Now, of course, all the time he'd been away in the United States and in the United Kingdom, he'd been treated more or less as anybody else during his various studies. But when he came back to India, he was an untouchable again. Didn't matter that he'd been away, he'd done all this, got quite prestigious education, been to quite prestigious establishment. None of that mattered. He was didn't matter if he had nice clothes or what have you. He was an untouchable again. So he went to take up his position in Baroda, and he struggled to find accommodation the first night that he got there. In the Hindu guest houses, they wouldn't give him a place because he wasn't untouchable. Eventually, he got was able to stay at a Parsi guest house. Now, Parsis aren't Hindus. They're descendants of Zoroastrians from Persia who migrated to India. And the guy who ran the guest house, the Parsi guy who ran the guest house, said, look, if you go under an assumed name, people won't know that you're an untouchable, they think you're Parsi, so do that, and you can stay here. So that's what he did. So he was able to do his job and stay at the Parsi guest house for a few days at least, until word got out, and then a group of Hindu men turned up with sticks and chased him away. So that was the end of his job at Baroda. So from there, he found work. He had a young family at this point, so he found work and was quite successful. He did had a variety of different employments, but amongst those where he was teaching, so he was a professor at educational establishments. He got on very well with students. He did have some difficulties with some of the other professors who were not happy that he shared the same drinking water jug as them, as he was an untouchable. He also had a business consultancy, and again he had difficulties when he lost clients. When they discovered he was untouchable, they didn't, tended not to come back again. But nevertheless, he prospered and did well. He also did a lot of work in terms of politics and with his local community. And by that, I tend to mean the community of untouchables with which he'd grown up. He led one quite well-known demonstration for his community. So there was some... There was a well-known temple with a well-known image called Kala, and that means the Lord Kala in black, and it's a black image of Lord Kala. So this was quite a notable image in this particular temple. And the thing was, though, the untouchables, despite normally being Hindus, weren't allowed into any of the temples because they supposedly were polluted. So none of the untouchables had actually seen this image of Kala, and they wanted to see it. So Dr. Ambedkar organised a demonstration, a peaceful march. So thousands of his community marched to the Kala temple in order to try and see this image. But the Brahmins that ran the temple locked the gates so that they couldn't get in. And I don't suppose this was any particular surprise to Dr. Ambedkar and his colleagues. I suppose that's what they were expecting, but they were just, I think, trying to demonstrate the circumstances, the difficulties that they faced. Incidentally, the term untouchable is quite pejorative, really. So I wouldn't tend to use that in sort of modern terms. But I'm using it at this stage because it's the term that Dr. Mbetko himself used. It's the term that was prevalent in those days, and it does say quite a bit, really, about the nature of it, of itself. So I'm going to be using that term for the moment. So he organised that demonstration. He also worked in politics and in economics. And he was very successful in many ways. In the law courts, he gained quite a reputation by having quite significant successes in certain cases. So, 1947, India gained independence from Britain. And Dr. Mbedkar was appointed the first law minister of the new country. So he had indeed come quite a long way from his quite humble beginnings. So he was the first law minister. He was also appointed the chairman of the committee that was to draft the constitution. And that's not to say, though, he didn't still face difficulties, despite the fact that he had a very senior position. He's one of the most senior people in the country. He had all this education and so on and so forth. He was still an untouchable in many people's eyes. So some of the people that worked for him in his office wouldn't hand him their papers if they had to give something to him, because they felt that would pollute them. So instead, if they wanted to give him something, they would put it on his desk and he would have to pick it up himself. The constitution that they came up with had, as you can imagine, it's quite a wide-ranging document, but amongst the things that it included were guarantee of the freedom of religious expression, the outlawing of untouchability, in fact, the outlawing of all forms of discrimination. And this constitution was passed by the Indian Assembly. In addition to that, Dr. Mbedkar brought forth proposals such that there would be a form of positive discrimination for what were called the untouchables. And at this point, the nomenclature changed. So untouchability, as I say, is quite a pejorative term. So they were, within the constitution, the people that were called untouchables were known as scheduled castes or scheduled tribes, depending upon which group they belonged to. So scheduled castes or scheduled tribes. So Dr. Mbedkar had these proposals that certain positions would be reserved, a quota of positions would be reserved for the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes within the civil service and within the education system, so in colleges and in schools, to try and overcome the huge discrimination that they had faced and were facing, and try and give them a bit of a boost get them employed and move things along for this community, this disadvantaged community. And these proposals too were accepted. He had less success, though, with another of his proposals on gender equality. He felt that the Assembly was dragging their heels, they were procrastinating, they didn't seem to want to make progress. And in the end, Dr. Mbedkar resigned from the Cabinet as a result of this. And but later he got appointed to the Indian Upper House, which is the parallel with our House of Lords. Dr. Mbedkar said that he was born a Hindu, but he would not die a Hindu. And so he spent some time investigating other systems of belief, other religions, and so on and so forth. And eventually he decided that he would convert to Buddhism. So in 1956, in Nagpur, he did just that. He converted to Buddhism. And it was a big event. There were, it's said, 500,000 of his supporters or his followers, at this event. And once he got converted, they all converted too. Unfortunately, within a couple of months of this event, Dr. Mbedkar died. So this was 1956, he was about 65 years old. He had been unwell for a number of years. He was diabetic and had struggled in a number of ways with his health for some time. But nevertheless, as you can imagine, it was quite a devastating event for his followers, following so quickly after this mass conversion. So, what was Dr. Mbedka's legacy then? Clearly it's not all about airports. He is, for one thing, rightly regarded as the architect of the Indian Constitution. He was voted in 2012 the greatest Indian, which is quite a thing, really, given the competition. This was a poll held by some TV channels, History TV 18 and the Indian wing of CNN. So he was voted the greatest Indian, and he received 20 million votes. Also, he's renowned as a social political reformer. His lifelong work in justice and equality has had a deep effect on modern India. He is renowned for his work in the fields of religion, politics, economics, and justice, and which are quite, you know, widely differing fields in some ways. It's quite a broad spectrum of events. And some of the things that have been said about him are, in relation to some of these different fields, are that he is the greatest educated Indian economist of all time. And there was no equal to his intelligence in terms of law, and that he's a great and renowned champion of human rights. As of the 2011 census in India, there are, or were, 8 million Buddhists in India. Of those, 90% are Dalits. Now, Dalits tend to be the current term for ex-untouchables. That tends to be the most frequently used modern term and the most politically acceptable term these days, Dalits. So 8 million Buddhists in India, 90% Dalits from the Dalit community. But on Dr. Mbedkar's death, there was a great void. There was nobody from the community who could really step into his, follow in his footsteps. There was all these followers, 8 million of them now, with a genuine desire for the Dharma, but no real access to it, no great access to teachers and so on. There was a huge void. Now, Bhante Sangharakshita, who was, as you're probably aware, the founder of our movement, was well aware of this, having spent 20-odd years in India himself. So, on the founding of our movement and our order, he encouraged order members to visit India to try to help. And one of the fruits of these endeavours is Nagaloka, which is an educational establishment in Nagpur. And I was fortunate enough to visit Nagaloka in 2013, following the order convention that was held in India. And it's a very impressive institution, actually. It's a really very nice campus, nice buildings. You can see how it's been built up over the time, over the decades, with the efforts and the endeavours and the commitment and the contributions of people like from our community, by and large. So the aim of Nagaloka is to try and help the most disadvantaged young people of Indian society. And when I visited there, I heard some talks from some of the students who were just ending their studies before going back home. And they said something about their backgrounds, where they came from, and the difficulties that they faced and so on. And what was striking, what it reminded me, really, was just how revolutionary the Buddha's teachings were and still are, at least in this context. And in particular, I'm referring in this context to the teaching that one's worth is not dependent upon one's birth, one's caste, one's parents, or so on. Instead, it's dependent upon your actions, your communication, your thoughts, your state of mind, and so on. In other words, largely due to your own efforts. Now, this was really revolutionary 2,500 years ago, but it's really revolutionary still today for these young people. These young people have grown up, in many cases, facing very difficult situations and a great deal of discrimination, being regarded by some people, if not many people, as polluting by nature. I mean, imagine what that must actually be like. Even if you're extremely confident, it must have quite a profound effect. I know, speaking for myself, there's incidents from my childhood that I can remember that are upsetting. And I'm sure, well, I'm not sure, but it's quite probable that you have sort of similar things. So imagine what it must be like to have that kind of weight on your own shoulders, that your very being is polluting. Imagine also what it must be like to be a parent, an untouchable parent, a Dalit parent, and to watch your child grow up learning that that is their nature, that that is how people regard them. So to be told that objectively that's a load of old nonsense and that's not the truth at all was quite revolutionary for these young people. It really was quite inspiring. They said how it had changed their lives. It was liberating, how it had freed their minds. It really had made a profound difference. So that was Nagaloka. And Nagaloka is not very far at all away from the place where Dr. Ambedkar was converted to Buddhism, became converted to Buddhism, both being in Nagpur. And the place where that took place is now, they built a commemorative building to remember the event. It's called the Deeksha Bhoomi. And there's also a descendant of the Bodhi tree there as well. And millions of pilgrims a year visit the Deeksha Bhoomi. It's important to emphasise just how important Dr. Ambedkar is to the Indian Buddhist community and the Dalit community. For example, there's a couple of things that I can think of. And one was that when I was on the Indian Order Convention, I was chatting to another Westerner. And he told me how he'd been having fun with some of the Indian people there. And they'd been trying to get him to learn Dr. Ambedkar's full name. And so they'd been teasing him a bit. And on one occasion they said, who is this? Pointing the picture of Dr. Ambedkar. And he thought, I know Dr. Ambedkar's name now, so that's not a problem. That is Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar. No, 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 they teased. That is Bodhisattva Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar. So a Bodhisattva, as you might be aware, is a being that dedicates his or her entire existence to liberate other living beings. So whether they believe Dr. Ambedkar is literally a Bodhisattva or not, I don't really know. But it's very interesting to see how Dr. Ambedkar is taking on mythic qualities in India. Also, I was listening to a radio show the other day where they were talking about India, and in this little segment they were talking about a very poor Dalit community, as Dalit communities tend to be, in Mumbai, who had scrimped and saved and managed to obtain a small one-room dwelling that they were going to use for their practice. And they went into this small one dwelling, and in there were two pictures. One was of the Buddha, and the other is of Dr. Ambedkar. So I think it is the case that Dr. Ambedkar very much lives on in the hearts and the minds of Indian Buddhists. But of course, the caste system is still present, and there is still discrimination. It has declined, I think, very much over the decades, but it is still present. It's difficult to change something like that overnight, something that's so ingrained with the culture, I think. And perhaps in some ways there are parallels with discrimination in this country, where discrimination against people on the basis of their sexuality is illegal. And, of course, you can have marriage between same sexes these days on the same basis as traditional marriages. But that doesn't mean that there can be not that there isn't discrimination in certain situations. So I think it could be a bit like that in India. So though discrimination is technically illegal, particularly in rural societies, there is still a great deal of discrimination on the basis of caste or untouchability still today. But things have changed. So, for example, there has been an Indian president who was a Dalit. So things definitely are moving on. Dr. Ambedkar, I think, did dedicate his life to improving the lot of his fellow Indians, and particularly the most disadvantaged. He was committed to justice, liberation and equality. And so I think it's true to say he genuinely was a servant of his society. So that's all I want to say just now about Dr. Ambedkar. Before we go on to the next bit, any questions at all?
With the caste system, do you have to do declare if someone asks you? And if not, how does someone find out?
Well, I think it's a bit like, I think you probably have to be Indian to be able to answer that question properly. I think it's a bit like, Indians do tend to think, I remember reading in Sangharajita's memoirs, he said how Indians tend to always ask certain questions so that in an endeavour to find out what someone's status is. Some things are indicators, like your job, often your name is an indicator of what your caste is. And there must be other telltale signs as well. I was thinking it's a bit like in England. We have a class system, and we know a lot about somebody just from, if they just say a few words to us, we can learn a huge amount about the person, about what part of the country they're from, in particular what their education is, and what their attitudes might well be, that sort of thing. So I think there's all sorts of telltale clues. There's nothing to stop somebody lying, I suppose, about it.
I was thinking about the original point. He could have lied when he was a child at the train station.
Yeah, he could have, yeah. He could have. But he was just a young lad and he didn't know any different, I suppose. But if you lie and you get found out, there's likely consequences, I think, as well. Or at least that was the case.
And learning to lie about your identity at the age of 9 seems like would be a fairly devastating sort of experience to go through, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah.
You know, that could be, you know, well, it sounds like all the experiences of people who are Dalits or untouchables would be very devastating from that point of view.
Mm.
But having to lie about who you are as well, that would give great, very great sense of shame.
Now that many Dalits have converted to Buddhism, how are those Buddhists then treated by the Hindus?
Not very well, by and large.
Still.
Yeah, they don't. I'm only hearing this second hand, but when on the convention, being able to talk to the Indian Order members, some of them do face quite extreme difficulties. So, for example, they don't have anywhere where they can meet. So, I think you were telling me this example, weren't you, about a group that had to meet in the park and found that they get stones thrown at them when they're trying to study. So they do. From the Hindu point of view, you know, the fact that they convert to Buddhism doesn't mean that they're not untouchables anymore.
Why haven't we heard? I mean, I don't think I'm the only person that hasn't heard of Dr. Ambedkar. You know, we had a film made about Gandhi, but there's been no film, there's been no books for the general public about him?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a good question. It would make a good film.
But it's because of the set. It's because he was an untouchable. Mm. That's why, it's just for the same reasons everything else Torrent has been saying.
It is kind of a mixed thing, though. In some ways, Indians are trying to make great efforts to overcome this. So the airport in Nagpur is named after him. There's statues of Ambedkar in lots of places in India. But there still is. So there's. It's like any sort of society. You know, there's different groups within it, and there's some people that want to try and overcome these sorts of discrimination that exist, and other people who are more traditional and don't want to do that.
I guess just because Obama is the first black president doesn't mean that black Americans don't get shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or imprisoned for war. Same in this country.
Yeah.
Not shot.
Well, black
people get shot.
Oh,
yes, I know, but not to the degree that in America.
Well, this does kind of take me on to my to the topic that I thought we'd introduce in our study groups, because I think you're quite right. There are different forms of discrimination in different places, and I'm sure we have discrimination. Well, I know we have discrimination in this country too. But what I'd like us to look at is our own discrimination, how we discriminate ourselves. So my question is, for the discussion, in what ways do you notice yourself discriminating? So you might need to think about this a little bit. I've got a couple of examples, which are a bit embarrassing, but I'm going to say them anyway, which is, I remember on one occasion, there was a meditation day here, and I'd been coming to the centre probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, something like that. And I knew the chairman at the time quite well. And he was sort of there at this meditation day on a Saturday or something like that. And I was chatting to him, and this other chap came up. He didn't have an imposing stature. And I wouldn't say I blanked him, but I didn't really pay any attention to him. And I was just continuing my communication with the chairman and ignoring this person. And then it turned out that this was the guy who was leading the meditation weekend, and he was quite a notable, well-known meditation teacher in our movement. And when I realised that, I realised how I'd had this attitude of, oh, you must be somebody who's quite new to the centre, and, you know, I don't need to pay attention to you. And whereas once I realised he was quite a notable meditation teacher, my attitude completely changed. So probably neither of these attitudes are entirely ethical. But anyway, it did make me realise, if nothing else, that my own prejudice on that particular occasion. So, I don't know, maybe you can think of other examples like that. So, on a hospital visit, do you treat the receptionist with the same respect as you do with the consultant? As the consultant? Or, with new people, is your willingness to communicate dependent upon how attractive you perceive them to be, for example? So, that's our discussion for today. In what ways do you notice yourself discriminating?